Well, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, the last day of September 2014. This will probably be the last time that I preside over a panel at the Court of Appeals before I take my new bench on January the 1st.
Who knows what the future holds?
We'll see. Articulating his approval on my right is Justice Bill Meyer, and on my left is Justice Lee Gabriel, and we are your panel for today. We have two cases set for oral argument, and we have four other cases being submitted without oral argument. So with that said, let's call the first case.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Hager. My co-counsel is Alexis Allen. We're here for the city of Justin. Your honors, this case evolves around the use of a roadway and the declaration of a roadway as a public road, private piece property within the town of Justin. We would ask the court to pay particular attention to Exhibit 39, Defendants 39, or Plaintiffs Number 2, which is the original town plat for the city of Justin, which denotes a 60-foot right-of-way for a road that is referred to as Colorado Avenue. That road is the road that's an issue here. The position of the city that through implied dedication from 1887 up and through the time of trial that this road was impliedly dedicated. As the original town plat, there is no dedicatory language in that plat, but does denote a 60-foot right-of-way for Colorado Avenue. The testimony at the trial of this matter clearly indicated that the road had been either referred to as a city street or was used as a city street almost from the time of its very inception. Although we did not have anyone from 1887 to come to court and testify in this case, there were deeds that were introduced as well as testimony of long-standing citizens of the city of Justin over the use of the roadway. Through that doctrine of implied dedication, which means that although there is no expressed written declaration of dedication for the public use, the use of this piece of property, the 60-foot right-of-way, had for many, many, many years been used by members of the general public. One of the other important factors to note in this case is the fact that the railroad owned the land from 1887 or 1886 up through 1994 when it was purchased by the plaintiff, in this case, Rimrock Enterprises. That property had been maintained, leased by the railroad for those 106 years. It was allowed to be used by members of the public. There was testimony that as far back as the 1930s that road was used. Ms. Hardiman, who is the principal at Rimrock, testified that the road had been used. Her father, who was a long-standing citizen, testified that that road had been used as a public road. There was testimony that it had been maintained. But what's most important, and what we would urge the court to pay particular attention to, is Exhibit 37A. And 37A is the exhibit where, as part of the closing documents, when Rimrock purchased the property. And on that survey that accompanied the closing documents, that exhibit, 37A, shows that there was a 60-foot public road, which is Colorado, which was the subject matter of this litigation. Ms. Hardiman acknowledged that she had seen that document, and it didn't mean much to her. She decided to pay no attention to that, and that was in 1994. When the city resurfaced the road in 2009, which has led to this lawsuit, which leads us to you this afternoon, it is our opinion, and we would urge the court to so find, that when the property owner had taken deed to the property, not only did her policy of title insurance disclose the street, the survey which she took title disclosed the street, and that was in 1994, and we think by the doctrine of prescription, we have prescriptive rights for that 60-foot right-of-way. The court's well aware the law has long been in Texas. It's not only the travel portion of the road, but the drainage and other areas around and in and around the road of which the public would make use. So it is our position that the prescriptive right from 1994 to 2004 would indicate that the city would be entitled to acquire its public right-of-way through the doctrine of prescription and through the doctrine of implied dedication, that this roadway had long been used by members of the public, was maintained by the public, and was really being resurfaced by the public, which led to the lawsuit. We think that, those are significant facts. Those facts are undisputed, and there's much evidence to support the finding, and the jury so found. One of the issues...
Mr. Hager?
Yes, sir.
You're talking about this original plat, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Do you have a copy of it close enough I can talk to you about it?
Yes, sir, I do.
When we are looking at the map, the top of the map is west, is that correct?
It is. North faces, if you have to turn it this way.
Yes, sir. I understand. Now, when we're looking at the word Colorado.
Yes, sir.
On the map, there, as you go up towards the west, going towards the top, there's a rectangle that's marked B. See that? Right above the word Colorado goes up, there's a rectangle that's marked B.
Don't, Your Honor. I see Colorado, I see the word reservation. And then I see Santa Fe Rail.
Well, this marked original plat that's been attached. I'm just wondering if you've got something different than what we have.
I would refer the court to what I'm calling is Exhibit Defendants 39. And
okay.
If 6th Street, 5th Street, if you can find that on your map, is 407.
I find two more rectangles that appear to be along the same general direction, if I can call it that, in terms of westbound, that appear to be two separate tracks somehow identified on this plat. It's too small, I can't read it.
I think we have different exhibits, Your Honor.
Okay.
And there's a group of for the court's edification, what I'm referring to as 45, 50, 51, and 46, and the property in issue, 5th Street, is FM 407. So that might be a frame of reference that the court may need to make as it looks at the record. If you will, Your Honors, some of the other points that we make in our brief, and I will, is the fact that if inverse condemnation or the doctrine of implied dedication give the city of Justin the right to use this as a public roadway, the inverse condemnation claims of the plaintiff in this case fail. If they fail, then the award of attorney's fees for any kind of declaratory judgment would likewise fail, in that there would be nothing to declare if the city owned the 60-foot right-of-way. We would also urge the court to look at the fact that there's issues that the plaintiff has raised on a declaratory judgment. Since they sued us for inverse condemnation and then later added the declaratory judgment action, if in fact the property had been inversely condemned, there was no future rights to declare, that in essence the declaratory judgment action was added in as a way to get attorney's fees on an eminent domain case for which attorney's fees are not awarded in the state of Texas. So it is our position that if the case lies in implied dedication or lies with prescriptive rights, that there can be no eminent domain proceeding, since all the city did acquire was the right to use the surface. If the city were to abandon this property later, it did not need that roadway. Of course, it would go back to the property owner of which the roadway was created out of.
Do you agree or disagree that the street dead-ended, the street dead-ended at both ends?
Yes,
and it was being used.
Originally, it did not, but the property to the south, Colorado actually extended further south, but it had been closed off and abandoned many years ago. So it dead ends at 407 and then dead ends into the parking lot of a, I believe it's a distributor of LP gas.
And the public is using a street that goes for two blocks and dead ends at both ends?
Goes for a little bit further in that. There's houses that are down there. There are people that live down there.
Okay.
There's businesses that have accessed Colorado, not only the Rimrock business and its predecessor, but there's been some other businesses that are along Colorado, as well as it enters into our industrial area to, I believe it is, to the east of Colorado. That's why the road was being resurfaced. I think that there was a road project to do the industrial park, which lies to the east of Colorado, and that the Economic Development Corporation paid for that infrastructure improvements, which included Colorado Avenue.
What was the evidence that prior to this project, the city maintained this road? Because it was my understanding that a predecessor to Rimrock actually surfaced the road in the manner that it was prior to this project being.
There was some evidence that the city had graded the road on occasion. There was more evidence that Ms. Hardiman's father had graded the road. And we think that that's important for the fact that that was the intent of the property owner, in this case, the railroad. They owned that when that road was graded. And I think that, well, you can't take judicial notice of the fact that the railroad has jealously guarded all of its land and its right-of-way over the years. They allowed that road to be used and intended for that road to be used as public access. The road was, I think there was testimony, Justice Gabriel, that a fence was put up on the western side of the road right away to enclose, if you will, the yard and the use of the property which Rimrock purchased. And that road, or that fence line, I think there's testimony and there's exhibits that show that that fence line matches up with the fence line of all the properties to the north, and again would evidence the road. So we believe and submit to the court, and it is our position with the court, that the railroad knew that it was a public right-of-way, treated it as a public right-of-way, allowed their tenant to treat it as a public right-of-way. And it's not necessarily the grading of the road or the maintenance of the road which would dictate the city's use for purposes of implied dedication. It's the public's use of the road. And it's clear without any equivocation in the evidence that the public used the road.
What you indicated earlier that the implied dedication included, your word was, drainage, but there really wasn't any drainage prior to this other than some ditches that just were there.
There was a culvert placed in there. There was ditches. Ditches are drainage for roadways. They're open bar ditches. They'd been cleaned out. I think there was testimony they'd been cleaned out by the city. And it was part of the redesign of that to regrade those bar ditches in the driveway, which was part of the improvements that were being made.
There was evidence that the city maintained those as drainage ditches for that roadway.
There's no direct testimony that there was a ditch project. There was some testimony that there had been some grass cutting and some other clean out of the ditches.
By the city?
Yes, ma'am.
So, are you going to dispute opposing counsel's brief that says in 1951 a trail, which was there, was mud, not gravel? Sometimes cars drove on it, but they couldn't when it rained. A predecessor put in the road and improved it with gravel in the late 50s or 60s. In the 70s, a predecessor upgraded it with chip seal, which is gravel with hot asphalt, to support the heavy equipment involved in the train car derailment business. Rimrock's chip seal road was 12 to 15 feet wide and ran the full 473 foot of the road. But you're saying that's wrong, that the city maintained it as a public street.
I'm saying that the public used it as a public street. It's not necessarily whether the city maintains it. It's the intent, the donative intent of the landowner. The landowner at the time was a railroad.
And it was a trail.
I would dispute that
1887, what, did you buy it? Did they just give it to you?
No, it was not. I think that probably
you took it?
That whole, no, I wouldn't say that we took it. I think when the town was laid out, if you look at 39A, there was the railroad laid out a scheme. Mr. Helms, when he laid it out, laid out Colorado Avenue. I don't think that the city, now you have to remember, this isn't Dallas, this ain't Fort Worth, this is Justin. Okay, and what happened in 1887 until the time that the city started growing here recently would indicate that they probably didn't maintain it as we would normally think of maintained roads. I think that the public used it. I think that the railroad intended for the public to use it and allowed their tenant to create an implied dedication by the public's use.
But isn't that just it, is donative intent? Because acquiescing and letting people get to their houses and use a road does not necessarily evidence donative intent, does it?
Not necessarily, but it is evidence. There's no evidence to indicate at any point in time when that began. So I think you're left with shrouded in obscurity. And when shrouded in obscurity means that the public's use of that area as a road indicates a donative intent by the landowner that the public used the road. They could have fenced it off.
And the jury could have found that if they thought that the evidence was sufficient to do that, but yet they didn't.
What they did find, because there was sufficient evidence, that there was an implied dedication. What I'm here to indicate, not to overturn my own verdict, but to look at the fact that what the width of that implied dedication is. And if the concept of implied dedication does not get you the full 60 feet, what about the landowner's notice that there's a public roadway 60 feet wide when they bought the land?
All right, thank you. Let's give opposing counsel 2 extra minutes.
Please the court. I'm Chris Barnes. I'm here for Appalee Rimrock Enterprises. Just to start with, I think I have the map you were looking for, Your Honor.
Good.
It says old
part
plat
of your exhibits. I was hoping that you had it.
That's Defendant's Exhibit 24 at 25 RR, page 81.
Yes, sir. And so can you tell me what that tract is that is, as you look at Colorado, that's immediately above Colorado, just looking at it on this in this posture, so that the west is the top. What is that track? What is that rectangle marked B?
I'm not sure what the individual B is, but the sum of B, A, and C, A, B, and C are is Rimrock's. So that's the southern portion of Rimrock's parcel. I'm not sure what the significance of why it got blocked on B, but for our case, you can see Colorado Avenue toward the bottom of the page, which is the east, but Rimrock's parcel includes that B and that A.
So the parcel is the long A, large rectangle, the B, and
yes,
then the smaller rectangle that is to the right side of the A.
Yes, sir, and underneath the A, too, toward the bottom of the page.
Yeah, and that's what's marked B on the one I'm looking at.
Okay.
So was any of that property with those lines like they're shown on this original plat, were any of those tracks fenced?
I believe A is fenced with...
But not B and C?
not to block use. That's correct, if that's what you're asking. What we would argue, what Rimrock would argue, if the significance of the road dead-ending is, again, it's not a general thoroughfare. It's a dead end on both ends. C.J. Hardiman, who owned and ran one of Rimrock's predecessors, testified, yes, a few neighbors lived there, and he let his neighbors get to their land. And Rimrock's position would be that's not acquiescence, that's insufficient for donative intent. And, again, the jury did hear all that.
Mr. Hardiman was a tenant, wasn't he?
Yes, sir. I guess so, but he's the tenant who built the road for his purposes.
He's the one who put the ceiling on the top of the gravel at some width.
And, that's correct.
And it's defended by your witnesses that it was 9 to 12 feet.
Wide. That's right. 12 to 15 feet wide is the pre-taking, with Carla Hardiman testified, was the pre-taking road.
But the distance between the lines where the pair that I've just been asking you about is 60 feet. In other words, when you look at the narrow rectangle to the right of A on this plat, that's your exhibit, that right down at the bottom in barely legible numbers is the word 60, which appears to be 60 with a mark behind it that indicates feet on most of the plats that I've looked at.
Yes, sir. And I agree. We just say the actual road, pre-taking road, was 12 to 15 feet, and certainly wasn't that 60. And we also disagree on the evidence of the ditches. We contend there was grass ditches that were ineffective, and Rimrock.
And I read your brief, and I understand that.
I'm here to answer questions. As far as responding, otherwise I was going to respond to a few brief points in the city's reply. First, I believe the trial judge did decide as a matter of law that the city's actions constituted as a taking as a matter of law. First, you can see by reading the jury charge at 6 CR 150 to 160, the elements of a taking were never submitted to the jury, or in the question whether the city's actions constituted taking was not submitted. Number two, the first jury question is, do you find that part of the Colorado Road on Rimrock's parcel was impliedly dedicated? That's a defensive counterclaim, meaning if the city had lost on that counterclaim, everything would have been taken. And then in the end, you can see that the judge, in the final judgment at 6 CR 333 to 335, granted or ordered that Rimrock take a little over $113,000 on its claim for inverse condemnation, and the trial judge granted it 473 by 60-foot easement. So she did decide that. As a matter of law. Also, the court can see the informal charge conference, because the city's last contention is that the trial judge did not decide it before submitting the case to the jury. And in the informal charge conference, which is at 16 RR Reporters Record 167 through about 191, here's some highlights, 16 RR 167, court. In other words, if we have two questions, was there implied dedication before 94? And then a second, was there implied dedication before June 09? Why aren't we having three questions? Was there an implied dedication after January 1, 2013? And Mr. Hager asks, if we miss on the first two, then it's somehow taken, right? And the court, yes. At 182 and 183 of 16 RR, the court, I can enter several judgments. Could we not agree that the existing road, that's the take? One way or another, can we agree that there's a take there if the jury does not find implied dedication? And then the court says a similar thing at 16 RR 189. So,
Mr. Barnes, then it's your contention that the place where the record reflects that the judge made a determination that there was a taking is in this exchange between counsel and the court in the charge conference?
Well, I think that's evidence, but I think you can tell from the jury questionnaire itself, because the first question is implied dedication.
I'm interested in you pointing out for me on the record, if you can, where does the judge announce, I find as a matter of law that there was a taking?
I would say it has to be, you'd have to look at the charge, but I agree the judge doesn't say it explicitly. But it's the meaning of the charge, because she says do you, jury, find that there was implied dedication, which if the jury says no, then it's all taken, and the land is taken.
So your contention that the judge made a finding of a taking is by deductive reasoning, by reading the language that's actually submitted in the jury charge, that we are to take, we are to assume that the judge made a final matter of law ruling that there was a taking.
Well, I believe that she at least made it by then. She definitely made it by the time of the final judgment, based on the final judgment's contents. And I would submit that the city knew, everybody at the, in the courthouse knew what the ruling was because of the informal charge conference. So the only thing that would be missing is an instruction in the charge for the trial court to turn to the jury and say, I rule that the city's actions constitute a taking. And if any, if that's anybody's error that that didn't happen, that's Rimrock's error. Certainly not the city's error, right? The city, it would have just been more prejudicial to the city. The judge would have turned to the jury and said, yeah, the city took the land. So if that's what you're saying is missing, I would say that that's maybe my complaint, but it's not the city's complaint. But the ruling was made.
Did the city ever ask that anything else go in the charge, such as a question to that effect or a instruction to that effect?
I don't see it in the... in the city's proposed instructions. Their instructions are at 6 CR 108 through about 120. Clearly in their instruction, they say the trial judge is supposed to decide the taking as a matter of law, which I think they did. So I think they've asked. I mean, it's not my position that the city didn't ask. It's my position the judge made the right decision. The second point is the city's argument on prejudice is that the city was forced to argue on the one hand that there was no taking, and on the other hand, offer defensive evidence on compensatory damages. And my point to that would be, first, the Supreme Court rejected that in Cragg, said all kinds of defendants faced uncertainty on liability and damages. But secondly, because taking is a question of law, the city was arguing there was no taking to the judge while it was offering evidence of defensive evidence of compensatory damages to the jury. So it's different decision makers, even if it's at the same time. But you're, they're not impeaching, the city wasn't impeaching itself in front of the same decision maker. But again, the significance of the of the informal charge conference is the city knew how the charge worked, you know, that the judge had found a taking.
Mr. Barnes.
Yes, sir.
How do you address the contention on the part of the city that both the survey that was in evidence from the time of the purchase of the property by Rimrock and the title insurance policy made reference to Colorado as a public road?
I guess my two responses, one would be that was all submitted to the jury. The jury found against the city, and it's not against... it doesn't meet, you know, sufficiency challenge. And secondly, the railroad's own agent, Matthew Hickey, testified, and we recite some of his testimony at pages 30 and 31 of our brief, but at 15, reporter's record, pages 73 to 109, he goes through and says, I was the railroad's agent for selling a bunch of this excess land. I looked at all the papers, and his conclusion was the railroad owned the road.
And the date of acquisition by Rimrock this property was in 1994?
October 1994, yes, or 24th or 25th.
Certainly more than 10 years before 2009.
Yes, sir. That's right. And I think as far as the limitations, I think, one, the facts on limitations were argued to the jury. The jury picked the date of the taking is June 15th, 2009. That's supported by Carla Hardiman's testimony. She was an eyewitness. She saw the construction start. She wrote the date down. That's what she testified to. I don't think if you compare the cases, I couldn't find that many summary judgment cases where the landowner lost, but the cases I found, like Wadi, the court said, well, landowner, you should have known because the sewer easement that you're complaining about, the sewer was installed over 10 years before. Well, here there's no comparable act of the city doing something over 10 years before. That there was in Wadi,
is the knowledge or the that timber cutting. Was the knowledge that would start the running of statute of limitations a required act on the part of the city or knowledge acquired by the owner?
Well, for implied dedication,
well, no, I'm talking about limitation here. I'm not talking about.
Okay. Well, right. If it's, I agree. If it's limitations on the inverse condemnation claim, it has to be on an act by the city, because inverse condemnation requires an intentional act by the city.
And I understand that. I'm talking about the starting of period of the running of limitations. If knowledge on the part of the owner that there was a contention, or that there was some indication that there was use by the public of a 60-foot wide right-of-way or roadway at the time that the property was acquired, is that knowledge alone sufficient to start the running of the statute of limitations?
Rimrock would argue it's not, Your Honor. One, many plats are going to say, here's the town's plotted out, the blocks are drawn in, it's going to have measurements. I don't think that says, by the way, you should have sued for inverse condemnation before.
I think it has to be a sufficient... The title insurance policy, given the exceptions, and I know you and I've read a lot of title insurance policies, and when they come around to looking at a possible indication of a ownership in fee simple interest on a title policy, they exclude it. And that's what happened here. He excluded the area of the 60-foot wide right-of-way possibility as far as the title company is concerned. They weren't making a determination that this has happened. They're merely limiting their exposure for a title claim on fee simple ownership of the area that is within what we're talking about in this lawsuit. And how's that? My concern is that's calling to the attention of the purchaser of the property. There could be some going on here with this roadway area.
Maybe in some circumstances. I think it was submitted to the jury. And secondly, the buyer here has been the tenant for generations and would say, but I know what the road was. I know what the title insurance policy is talking about. It's our road. We built it. We built it for our purposes. We let our neighbors use it. I don't think... It's not a stranger coming to it saying, I need additional investigation. Here it's the buyer is the one who put in the road and so feels confident it's my road. That's why I put it there. It's there for my business purposes. I fenced the yard next to it off to prevent theft. You know, the fence is for private purposes. I don't think it tells this owner on these facts that she should have sued for.
Thank you, sir.
If there's no other questions, I'll...
Anything further?
I'll give my time back.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
One of the points that we would like to make in rebuttal is there was testimony, and I believe if you look at defendants' exhibits 5 and 6, where there were work orders for the roadway as well as the placement of a stop sign. And we would like to submit to you the testimony of Matthew Hickey, who was worked for Catullus Management Corporation, which he testified was the real estate arm of the Santa Fe Railroad. So that's basically the owner testifying. And again, we would put you back to Exhibit 37A, which is a plat or a survey that was actually submitted to Rimrock, who bought the land from Catullus Management. So it's the owner representing to the purchaser what the status of the property was, and it clearly indicated a 60-foot public roadway, and even has on that the asphalt paved portion or the beaten path portion. We would also submit to the court the case of Allen versus Keeley, which is at 313 Southwest 2nd, 253, and Robertson Water versus Say, 545 Southwest 2nd, 253, which are cases involving prescriptive rights in roadways, where they say that the prescriptive right is not only the beaten path, but sufficient land were reasonably available for the drainage ditches, repairs, and the convenience of the traveling public. Both those cases stand for that, both are prescriptive rights cases, and we would submit those to the court to answer some of the questions of Justice Gabriel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Wait, Mr. Tiger, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Sorry.
That's okay.
what do you have to say about the appellee's contention that the court made a matter of law finding that there was a taking by virtue of the way the issues were submitted and question number one, and by virtue of exchange of discussion between counsel at the charge conference?
I would disagree with my co-counsel, or my, not my co-counsel, but counsel for the appellee on that issue. And as a matter of fact, Your Honors, the record is replete with requests by us that they bifurcate this proceeding so that they could separate these issues so the court can make a proper finding of taking. We don't believe that issue was ever addressed by the court, but was merely an answer, if you will, to the damage claim. And that was one of the problems with this case, where there was these prescriptive rights along with these issues of inverse condemnation or misuses. Both the plaintiff and the defendant in this case are faced with the possibility of having to kind of talk out of both sides of your mouth.
Can you tell me from your briefing and experience with this case and with others, any authority for an appellate court concluding that a trial judge made a finding as a matter of law by implication?
I'm not aware of that.
Thank you.
So the trial court either found there was a taking, found there was not a taking, or made no finding. Now, what is your position?
It would be my position that she made no finding, and therefore the award of damages was in.
Okay.
Final judgment in and of itself finds a taking, does it not?
I think it refers that there was a taking.
Okay, so that at the very latest, she made that finding in the final judgment.
She made that finding in the final judgment.
Okay.
She didn't make it by the time she submitted the case to the jury, however.
Does it make a difference?
I think it's
a matter of law ruling.
I think it makes
There's nothing to submit to the jury.
I think it makes
jury.
A difference in this case is because the way the jurors were submitted the question and what the court then found on implied dedication. There was a finding of implied dedication, which is a jury finding which is supported by the evidence. So what's the extent of the implied dedication? Should have been 60 feet. There should have been no taking.
To the jury charge questions in the form that they were given because the court had not made a finding concerning whether there was a taking or not?
Yes, I believe we did.
You made that objection at the time of trial?
I believe we did, because I think we argued that the issue of taking had to be made by the court. The court had not made that decision prior to submitting the case to the jury. She did not make, she should have made an instruction. To that effect.
Mr. Pegger, what is the date that the city contends was the start of the 10-year statute of limitations?
October of 1994, when she bought the land and received a copy of the notice from her predecessor in title.
Thank you for answering the question, sir.
All right, thank you. Your case is submitted. Does anyone wish to take a break before we go?
I'm okay.
Right. All right.